Adrienne Rich is a very special person, and to try to describe who she was, I had to go back to the 11th century. I decided that discovering Adrienne Rich's writing is akin to visiting the Bayeux tapestries in France. One doesn't arrive there by accident. The Bayeux was created to tell the history of the Norman invasion, but the guidebooks tell you that it isn't a tapestry, it's an embroidery. The wool threads, the symbols and composition have their own vocabulary, their own fine articulation and pattern. The guidebook declares that this embroidery is incomparable in quality. Nowhere does it mention that this work was created by women. It is assumed that the designer was male, and the embroideresses remain anonymous, taken for granted, invisible. Adrienne Rich is a writer whose early recognition made her visible. Her first book, A Change of World, written when she was a senior at Radcliffe College, was selected by W.H. Auden for the Yale Younger Poets Award in 1951. Her next book won the Ridgely Torrance Memorial Award from the Poetry Society of America. She has won numerous honors, awards, and fellowships. Her books document her journey from formal objective poetry to expressive woman-centered writing. I don't know why I'm so nervous. The Diamond Cutters, Snapshots of a Daughter-in-Law, Necessities of Life, Leaflets, The Will to Change, Diving into the Wreck, 21 Love Poems, The Dream of a Common Language, A Wild Patience Has Taken Me This Far, and two prose books of Woman Born, Motherhood as Experience and Institution, and On Lies, Secrets, and Silence. In the early 1970s, Rich decided to speak out, to be open concerning certain invisible subjects, lesbianism, lesbian mothers' rights, abortion rights, women's histories, stories, experiences. In 1976, she rejected the National Book Award as an individual, but accepted it with two other women nominees, Audre Lorde and Alice Walker. In the name of all women whose voices have gone and still go unheard. Her poems chisel the war of images, the need for integrity on our minds and hearts. Canadian writer Margaret Atwood notes, Adrienne Rich is not just one of America's best feminist poets, she's one of America's best poets. I'd like to add, she's a poet unequaled for her craft, her intense grappling with difficult questions, one of the world's truest poets, Adrienne Rich.
As usual. We have sound. Okay, I'll just hold this because these lavalier mics are not my favorite type. Can you make this move up? Never mind, I'll just hold it, it'll be all right. I want to thank Jan for that extremely moving introduction. I also want to thank both the Jans, Jan Castro and Jan Rothschild, for making this event possible, and for all the hard work, behind-the-scenes work that I know they both have put into this and the other events in this series. And I also want to thank the musicians, Cara Mia, Antonello and Manuel Ramos for their music. Listening to them, I found myself thinking about the incredible devotion and discipline that goes into the making of musicianship like that. All the things that are given up in order to possess oneself of an art to that extent. And it made me decide that I was going to change the reading a little bit, because it made me want to read a poem which has something to do with music. It's a poem called Transcendental Etude, and I'm going to start with this, although it's a rather long poem and I usually end with it, but I'd like to start with it because I'd like you to hear it after the music that we've all heard. One of the origins of this poem was a conversation that I had with my mother, who's now in her 80s. She was then 79. She, as a very young woman, was trained as a concert pianist and studied at Juilliard and studied in Europe, and then gave it up when she gave up that career when she married, and but continued to play the piano, so that I lived with her music all through my childhood. And she was, and still is, I think, a woman who spoke her passions through the piano more than in her voice or in any other way. And I'd been given a recording of a series of piano pieces by the composer Franz Liszt called Transcendental Etudes, very dazzling music. And Liszt, of course, was a pianist of such enormous accomplishment that he, in his own lifetime, and probably in any lifetime, was able to play music that was so hard that no one else could play it. And the problem was that he also composed music that was so difficult that no one but him could play it. And he lived before the time of sound recordings and became aware that if he didn't do something about this situation, his music was going to die with him. And so he rewrote the Transcendental Etudes, this is the story, making them more accessible to the lesser virtuosi. Anyway, with all this in mind, I went to my mother and said, what is the difference between a person who is just a fine musician and a virtuoso? And she didn't skip a beat and immediately answered, competitiveness. And I thought about that a lot, particularly coming from the woman that said it. Transcendental Etude. This August evening, I've been driving over back roads fringed with Queen Anne's lace, my car startling young deer in meadows. One gave a hoarse intake of her breath, and all four fawns sprang after her into the dark maples. 3 months from today, they'll be fair game for the hit-and-run hunters, glorying in a weekend's destructive power, triggers fingered by drunken gunmen, sometimes so inept as to leave the shattered animal stunned in her blood. But this evening, deep in summer, the deer are still alive and free, nibbling apples from early laden boughs, so weighted, so englobed with already yellowing fruit, they seem eternal, Hesperidean, in the clear-tuned, cricket-throbbing air. Later, I stood in the dooryard, my nerves singing the immense fragility of all this sweetness, this green world already sentimentalized, photographed, advertised to death. Yet it persists stubbornly beyond the fake Vermont of antique barn boards glazed into discotheques, artificial snow, the sick Vermont of children conceived in apathy grown to winters of rot-gut violence, poverty gnashing its teeth like a blind cat at their lives. Still it persists, turning off onto a dirt road from the raw cuts bulldozed through a quiet village for the tourist run to Canada. I've sat on a stone fence above a great, soft, sloping field of musing heifers, a farmstead slanting its plains calmly in the calm light, a dead elm raising bleached arms above a green so dense with life, minute, momentary life, slugs, moles, pheasants, gnats, spiders, moths, hummingbirds, groundhogs, butterflies. A lifetime is too narrow to understand it all, beginning with the huge rock shelves that underlie all that life. No one ever told us we had to study our lives, make of our lives a study, as if learning natural history or music, that we should begin with the simple exercises first and slowly go on trying the hard ones, practicing till strength and accuracy became one with the daring to leap into transcendence, take the chance of breaking down in the wild arpeggio or faulting the full sentence of the fugue. And in fact, we can't live like that. We take on everything at once before we've even begun to read or mark time. We're forced to begin in the midst of the hardest movement, the one already sounding as we are born. At most, we're allowed a few months of simply listening to the simple line of a woman's voice singing a child against her heart. Everything else is too soon, too sudden, the wrenching apart, that woman's heartbeat, heard ever after from a distance, the loss of that ground note echoing whenever we are happy or in despair. Everything else seems beyond us. We aren't ready for it. Nothing that was said is true for us, caught naked in the argument, the counterpoint, trying to sight-read what our fingers can't keep up with, learn by heart what we can't even read. And yet it is this we were born to. We aren't virtuosi or child prodigies. There are no prodigies in this world, only a half-blind, stubborn cleaving to the timbre of what we are. Stubborn cleaving to the timbre, the tones of what we are, even when all the texts describe it differently. And we're not performers like Liszt, competing against the world for speed and brilliance. The 79-year-old pianist said when I asked her, what makes a virtuoso? Competitiveness. The longer I live, the more I mistrust theatricality, the false glamour cast by performance, the more I know its poverty beside the truths we are salvaging from the splitting open of our lives. The woman who sits watching, listening, eyes moving in the darkness, is rehearsing in her body, hearing out in her blood, a score touched off in her, perhaps, by some words, a few chords from the stage, a tale only she can tell. But there come times, perhaps this is one of them, when we have to take ourselves more seriously or die, when we have to pull back from the incantations, rhythms we've moved to thoughtlessly, and disenthrall ourselves, bestow ourselves to silence or a deeper listening, cleansed of oratory, formulas, choruses, laments, static, crowding the wires. We cut the wires, find ourselves in free fall, as if our true home were the undimensional solitudes, the rift in the great nebula. No one who survives to speak new language has avoided this, the cutting away of an old force that held her rooted to an old ground, the pitch of utter loneliness, where she herself and all creation seem equally dispersed, weightless, her being a cry to which no echo comes or can ever come. But in fact, we were always like this, rootless, dismembered. Knowing it makes the difference. Birth stripped our birthright from us, tore us from a woman, from women, from ourselves so early on, and the whole chorus throbbing at our ears, like midges, told us nothing, nothing of origins, nothing we needed to know, nothing that could remember us. Only that it is unnatural, the homesickness for a woman, for ourselves, for that acute joy at the shadow her head and arms cast on a wall, her heavy or slender thighs on which we lay, flesh against flesh, eyes steady on the face of love, smell of her milk, her sweat, terror of her disappearance, all fused in this hunger for the element they have called most dangerous, to be lifted, breath taken on her breast, to rock within her, even if beaten back, stranded again, to apprehend in a sudden, brine-clear thought, trembling like the tiny, orbed, endangered egg sac of a new world. This is what she was to me, and this is how I can love myself as only a woman can love me. Homesick for myself, for her, as after the heat wave breaks, the clear tones of the world manifest, cloud, bough, wall, insect, the very soul of light. Homesick as the fluted vault of desire articulates itself. I am the lover and the loved, home and wanderer, she who splits firewood and she who knocks a stranger in the storm. Two women, eye to eye, measuring each other's spirit, each other's limitless desire. A whole new poetry beginning here. Vision begins to happen in such a life, as if a woman quietly walked away from the argument and jargon in a room, and sitting down in the kitchen, began turning in her lap bits of yarn, calico and velvet scraps, laying them out absently on the scrubbed boards, in the lamplight, with small rainbow-colored shells, sent in cotton wool from somewhere far away, and skeins of milkweed from the nearest meadow, original domestic silk, the finest findings, and the dark blue petal of the petunia, and the dry, dark brown lace of seaweed, not forgotten either the shed silver whisker of the cat, the spiral of paper wasp nest curling beside the finch's yellow feather. Such a composition has nothing to do with eternity, the striving for greatness, brilliance, only with the musing of a mind, one with her body, experienced fingers quietly pushing dark against bright, silk against roughness, pulling the tenets of a life together, with no mere will to mastery, only care for the many lived, unending forms in which she finds herself, becoming now the shard of broken glass, slicing light in a corner, dangerous to flesh, now the plentiful soft leaf that wrapped round the throbbing finger soothes the wound, and now the stone foundation, rock shelf further forming underneath everything that grows. I'm now going to read a very short poem, which is called Power. Living in the earth deposits of our history. Today, a backhoe divulged out of a crumbling flank of earth, one bottle, amber, perfect, 100-year-old cure for fever or melancholy, a tonic for living on this earth in the winters of this climate. Today, I was reading about Marie Curie. She must have known she suffered from radiation sickness. Her body bombarded for years by the element she had purified. It seems she denied to the end the source of the cataracts on her eyes, the cracked and suppurating skin of her finger ends, till she could no longer hold a test tube or a pencil. She died, a famous woman, denying her wounds, denying her wounds came from the same source as her power. So this poem feels as if it becomes more and more relevant. A fogged hill scene on an enormous continent. Intimacy rigged with terrors. A sequence of blurs the Chinese painter's ink stick planned. A scene of desolation comforted by two human figures recklessly exposed, leaning together in a stick-like boat in the foreground. Maybe we look like this, I don't know. I'm wondering whether we even have what we think we have. Lighted windows signifying shelter, a film of domesticity over fragile roofs. I know I'm partly somewhere else, huts strung across a drought-stretched land, not mine. Dried breasts, mine and not mine, a mother watching my children shrink with hunger. I live in my Western skin, my Western vision, torn and flung to what I can't control or even fathom. Quantify suffering, you could rule the world. They can rule the world. While they can persuade us our pain belongs in some order. Is death by famine worse than death by suicide, than a life of famine and suicide? If a black lesbian dies, if a white prostitute dies, if a woman genius starves herself to feed others, self-hatred battening on her body, something that kills us or leaves us half alive, is raging under the name of an act of God in Chad, in Niger, in the Upper Volta. Yes, that male God that acts on us and on our children, that male state that acts on us and on our children, till our brains are blunted by malnutrition, yet sharpened by the passion for survival, our powers expended daily on the struggle to hand a kind of life on to our children, to change reality for our lovers, even in a single trembling drop of water. We can look at each other through both our lifetimes, like those two figures in the stick-like boat, flung together in the Chinese ink scene. Even our intimacies are rigged with terror. Quantify suffering. My guilt, at least, is open. I stand convicted by all my convictions. You, too. We shrink from touching our power. We shrink away. We starve ourselves and each other. We're scared shitless of what it could be to take and use our love, hose it on a city on a world, to wield and guide its spray, destroying poisons, parasites, rats, viruses, like the terrible mothers we long and dread to be. The decision to feed the world is the real decision. No revolution has chosen it, for that choice requires that women shall be free. I choke on the taste of bread in North America, but the taste of hunger in North America is poisoning me. Yes, I'm alive to write these words, to leaf through Kollwitz's women, huddling the stricken children into their stricken arms, the mothers drained of milk, the survivors driven to self-abortion, self-starvation, to a vision bitter, concrete, and wordless. I'm alive to want more than life, want it for others starving and unborn, to name the deprivations boring into my will, my affections, into the brains of daughters, sisters, lovers, caught in the crossfire of terrorists of the mind. In the black mirror of the subway window hangs my own face, hollow with anger and desire. Swathed in exhaustion, on the trampled newsprint, a woman shields a dead child from the camera. The passion to be inscribes her body. Until we find each other, we are alone. And this is called The Lioness. The scent of her beauty draws me to her place. The desert stretches edge from edge. Rock, silver grasses, drinking hole, the starry sky. The lioness pauses in her back and forth pacing of 3 yards square and looks at me. Her eyes are truthful. They mirror rivers, seacoasts, volcanoes, the warmth of moon-bathed promontories. Under her haunches' golden hide flows an innate, half-abnegated power. Her walk is bounded, 3 square yards encompass where she goes. In country like this, I say, the problem is always one of straying too far, not of staying within bounds. There are caves, high rocks you don't explore, yet you know they exist. Her proud, vulnerable head sniffs toward them. It is her country. She knows they exist. I come towards her in the starlight. I look into her eyes as one who loves can look, entering the space behind her eyeballs, leaving myself outside. So at last, through her pupils, I see what she is seeing. Between her and the river's flood, the volcano veiled in rainbow, a pen that measures 3 yards square, lashed bars, the cage, the penance. And this is called Coast to Coast. There are days when housework seems the only outlet. Old funnel I've poured cauldrons through, old servitude. In grief and fury bending to the accustomed tasks, the vacuum cleaner plowing realms of dust, the mirror scoured, gray webs behind framed photographs brushed away, The gray-seamed sky enormous in the west, snow gathering in corners of the north. Seeing through the prism, you who gave it me, you bearing ceaselessly yourself the witness. Rainbow dissolves the Hudson. This cherry stinting skin of late winter, ice forming and breaking up, the unprotected seeing it through with their ordinary valor. Rainbow composed of ordinary light, February flat, gray white of a cheap enameled pan, breaking into viridian, azure, violet. You write, 3.5 weeks lost from writing. I think of the word protection, who it is we try to protect and why. Seeing through the prism, your face fog hollowed, burning cold of eucalyptus hung with butterflies, lavender of rock bloom. Oh, and your anger uttered in silence, word and stammer, shattering the fog, lances of sun piercing the gray Pacific, unanswerable tide, carving itself in clefts and fissures of the rock, beauty of your breasts, your hands, turning a stone, a shell, a weed, a prism in coastal light. Traveler and witness, the passion of the speechless driving your speech, protectless. If you can read and understand this poem, send something back, a burning strand of hair, a still warm, still liquid drop of blood, a shell thickened from being battered year on year. Send something back. Well, the next poem has an epigraph, and the epigraph is part of the inscription on a landmark erected by the Historical Landmark Council at the intersection of Highways 281 and 4, 14 miles north of Red Cloud, Nebraska, which was where the novelist Willa Cather grew up. And this marker says in part, "Here on the divide between the Republican and the Little Blue, lived some of the most courageous people of the frontier. Their fortunes and their loves live again in the writings of Willa Cather, daughter of the plains and interpreter of man's growth in these fields and in the valleys beyond. On this beautiful, ever-changing land, man fought to establish a home. In her vision of the plow against the sun, symbol of the beauty and importance of work, Willa Cather caught the eternal blending of earth and sky," etc. The name of the poem is "For Julia in Nebraska." In the Midwest of Willa Cather, the railroad looks like a braid of hair, a grandmother's strong hands plaited straight down a granddaughter's back. Out there last autumn, the streets dreamed copper luster, the fields of winter wheat whispered long snows yet to fall. We were talking of matrices, and now it's spring again already. This stormy Sunday lashed with rain, I call you in Nebraska. Here you're planting your garden, sanding and oiling a burl of wood. Hear in your voice the intention to survive the long war between mind and body. And we make a promise to talk this year about growing older. And I think we're making a pledge. Though not much in books of ritual is useful between women, we still can make vows together, long distance in electrical code. Today, you were promising me to live And I took your word, Julia, as if it were my own. We'll live to grow old and talk about it too. I've listened to your words, seen you stand by the cauldron's glare, rendering grammar by the heat of your womanly wrath. Brave linguist, bearing your double axe and shield, painfully honed and polished, no word lies cool on your tongue, bent on restoring meaning to our lesbian names, in quiet fury, weaving the chronicle so violently torn. On this beautiful, ever-changing land, the historical marker says, man fought to establish a home, fought whom the marker is mute. They named this Catherland for Willa Cather, lesbian, the marker is mute. The marker, white men set on a soil of broken treaties, Indian blood, women wiped out in childbirth, massacres. For Willa Cather, lesbian, whose letters were burnt in shame. Dear Julia, Willa knew at her death that the very air was changing, that her archbishop's skies would hardly survive his life. She knew as well that history is neither your script nor mine. It is the pictograph from which the young must learn, like Tom Outland, from people discredited or dead, that it needs a telling as plain as the prairie, as the tale of a young girl or an old woman told by tongues that loved them. And Willa, who could not tell her own story as it was, left us her stern and delicate respect for the lives she loved. How are we going to do better? For that's the question that lies beyond our excavations, the question I ask of you and myself when our maps diverge, when we miss signals, fail. And if I've written in passion, live, Julia, what was I writing but my own pledge to myself, where the love of women is rooted? And what was I invoking but the matrices we weave, web upon web, delicate rafters flung in audacity to the prairie skies, nets of telepathy contrived to outlast the iron road laid out in blood across the land they called virgin, nets, strands, a braid of hair, a grandmother's strong hands plaited straight down a granddaughter's back. This poem is called Heroines, and it's addressed to a kind of collective entity. It's not a single woman, but it could be one of many, many women who agitated in the suffrage movement of the 19th century in this country, and who before that had agitated in the abolitionist movement. White middle-class women whose names have begun to finally come down to us. When I was in school, in college, if you said Susan B. Anthony, everybody laughed, but you didn't know why. Stanton I had not even heard of. And then I think we knew that there was a strange person named Carrie Nation who went around smashing taverns with an axe. That entire movement had been wiped out of recall. In rediscovering our history in this new resurgence of feminism, it has seemed increasingly important to me that we think about the the women whom we respect, whom we single out as our heroines, and that we know them, we learn to know them as human women, as not as superhuman women. The temptation to make heroines who are somehow untouchable, unimpeachable, is very strong. I think that any oppressed group has a tremendous need and longing for figures on which to project and on which to pin. We know them, we learn to know them as human women, as not as superhuman women. The temptation to make heroines who are somehow untouchable, unimpeachable, is very strong. I think that any oppressed group has a tremendous need and longing for figures on which to project and on which to pin our needs for a sense of identity, autonomy, power, courage, resistance. And this poem is really about coming to terms with those women, with both their enormous achievements and their limitations. Exceptional, even deviant, you draw your long skirts across the 19th century. Your mind burns long after death, not like the harbor beacon, but like a pyre of driftwood on the beach. You are spared illiteracy, death by pneumonia, teeth which leave the gums, the seamstress's clouded eyes, the mill girl's shortening breath, by a collection of circumstances soon to be known as class privilege. The law says you can possess nothing in a world where property is everything. You belong first to your father, then to him who chooses you. If you fail to marry, you are without recourse, unable to earn a working man's salary, forbidden to vote, forbidden to speak in public. If married, you are legally dead. The law says you may not bequeath property save to your children or male kin, that your husband has the right of the slaveholder to hunt down and repossess you should you escape. You may inherit slaves, but have no power to free them. Your skin is fair. You have been taught that light came to the dark continent with white power, that the Indians live in filth and occult animal rites. Your mother wore corsets to choke her spirit, which if you refuse, you are jeered for refusing. You have heard many sermons and have carried your own interpretations locked in your heart. You are a woman strong in health through a collection of circumstances soon to be known as class privilege, which if you break the social compact, you lose outright. When you open your mouth in public, human excrement is flung at you. You are exceptional in personal circumstance. In indignation, you give up believing in protection, in scripture, in man-made laws. Respectable as you look, you are an outlaw. Your mind burns, not like the harbor beacon, but like a fire of fiercer origin. You begin speaking out, and a great gust of freedom rushes in with your words. Yet still you speak in the shattered language of a partial vision. You draw your long skirts, deviant, across the 19th century, registering injustice, failing to make it whole. How can I fail to love your clarity and fury? How can I give you all your due, take courage from your courage, honor your exact legacy as it is, recognizing as well that it is not enough? And I'm going to read in connection with that poem, because I think they are connected in certain ways, one section from the sequence at the end of this book called Turning the Wheel. And this is called Particularity. In search of the desert witch, the shamaness, forget the archetypes. Forget the dark and lithic profile. Do not scan the clouds massed on the horizon, violet and green, for her icon. Do not pursue the ready-made abstraction. Do not peer for symbols. So long as you want her faceless, without smell or voice, so long as she does not squat to urinate or scratch herself, so long as she does not snore beneath her blanket or grimace as she grasps the stone-cold grinding stone at dawn, so long as she does not have her own peculiar face, slightly wall-eyed or with a streak of topaz lightning in the blackness of one eye, so long as she does not limp, so long as you try to simplify her meaning, so long as she merely symbolizes power, she is kept helpless and conventional, her true power routed backward into the past. We cannot touch or name her, and barred from participation by those who need her, she stifles in unspeakable loneliness. And this is called For Memory. Old words, trust, fidelity, nothing new yet to take their place. I rake leaves, clear the lawn, October grass, painfully green beneath the gold. And in this silent labor, thoughts of you start up. I hear your voice, disloyalty, betrayal, stinging the wires. I stuff the old leaves into sacks, and still they fall, and still I see my work undone. One shivering, rain-swept afternoon, and the whole job to be done over. I can't know what you know unless you tell me. There are gashes in our understandings of this world. We came together in a common fury of direction, barely mentioning difference. What drew our finest hairs to fire? The deep, difficult troughs unvoiced. I fell through a basement railing the first day of school and cut my forehead open. Did I ever tell you? More than 40 years, and I still remember smelling my own blood like the smell of a new school book. And did you ever tell me how your mother called you in from play, and from whom to what? These atoms filmed by ordinary dust, that common life we each and all bent out of orbit from, to which we must return simply to say, this is where I came from. This is what I knew. The past is not a husk, yet change goes on. Freedom, it isn't once to walk out under the Milky Way, feeling the rivers of light, the fields of dark. Freedom is daily, prose bound, routine, remembering, putting together, inch by inch, the starry worlds from all the lost collections. Thank you.